A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about the unipolar versus bipolar divide in depression, and he puts it in this wonderfully honest way. He says bipolar sometimes feels like the more glamorous twin in popular culture, even though it's devastating in reality. His own experience is with mild unipolar depression, secondary to ADHD. He describes it as boringly unipolar, which I appreciate. And he's curious about what psychiatry actually knows about why most people with depression have the unipolar variant. Is there something protective against emotional lability? And what do the prevalence numbers actually look like?
That's such a well-framed question, because it cuts straight through the cultural noise to the actual biology. And you're right, the Hollywood version of bipolar has done a real disservice here.
The glamorous twin. I can see the machinery at work. You get the tortured artist narrative, the manic creative genius, the wild spending sprees that make for good television. Unipolar depression is just someone not getting out of bed for 6 months. Harder to sell.
Harder to sell, and yet it's vastly more common. Let me lay out the numbers. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, about 21 million American adults, roughly 8.3%, had at least one major depressive episode in the past year. That's unipolar territory. Bipolar disorder affects about 4.4% of adults over their lifetime, and that's the broadest definition, including bipolar 2 and subthreshold cases. When you look at lifetime prevalence, major depressive disorder hits about 21% in the US, more than 1 in 5 people. Bipolar 1 sits at about 1% lifetime. Bipolar 2 adds another 1 to 2%. So unipolar is genuinely an order of magnitude more common.
Which makes the Hollywood inversion even funnier. The rare thing gets all the screen time.
But the deeper question, the one the prompt is really driving at, is why. What's actually different in the brain such that one person's depressive illness stays unipolar while another's develops into bipolar? And is there something protective in the unipolar brain?
Because the prompt's framing is almost asking it from the other direction. Not what goes wrong in bipolar, but what goes right enough in unipolar to keep it from tipping over.
That's a productive way to think about it. Let me start with heritability, because that's where the biggest signal lives. Bipolar disorder is one of the most heritable conditions in all of psychiatry. Twin studies put it at 60 to 85%. For unipolar depression, it's more like 37 to 40%. That's a huge gap. And it has a really interesting implication. If bipolar is more genetically determined, the tendency toward mood lability, toward oscillation between poles, is something you either inherit or you largely don't. Unipolar depression, with its lower heritability, is more environmentally shaped. Stress, trauma, life events, inflammation, all of that plays a bigger role.
One way to frame it, bipolar is what happens when you have a strong genetic predisposition toward mood instability, and then life activates it. Unipolar is what happens when life itself is enough to depress you, without that underlying oscillatory machinery.
That's a rough but not unreasonable shorthand. It gets at something the prompt is dancing around. Emotional lability as almost a separate dimension from depression itself. You could be depressed without being labile. Most people are. Lability seems to require a specific genetic substrate.
What do we know about what that substrate actually is? If I looked at two brains side by side, one unipolar, one bipolar. What am I seeing?
This is where the neuroimaging literature gets interesting. The amygdala, the brain's threat detector and emotional salience processor, tends to be smaller in bipolar disorder than in healthy controls and shows hyperactivity during mood episodes. In unipolar depression, the amygdala also shows abnormalities, but they're different in pattern and often less pronounced. The real distinction seems to live in the prefrontal cortex and its connection to the amygdala. The prefrontal cortex is your brain's brake system. It regulates emotion, puts the lid on impulses. In bipolar disorder, there's consistent evidence of reduced gray matter volume in the prefrontal cortex, particularly in regions involved in inhibitory control.
The brake pads are worn down.
In unipolar depression, the prefrontal abnormalities are there, but more subtle and involving different subregions. More the areas involved in rumination and self-referential thinking, less the areas for pure impulse suppression. There's an elegant study from the Enigma Consortium. They pooled brain scans from thousands of patients across dozens of sites. They found bipolar disorder is associated with the largest cortical thinning in the pars orbitalis and pars triangularis, parts of the inferior frontal gyrus critical for response inhibition.
Say those names again. I want people to hear how specific this is.
Pars orbitalis and pars triangularis. They're subdivisions of Broca's area, more famous for language, but also heavily involved in stopping yourself from doing something you've already started. In bipolar, those regions are consistently thinner. In unipolar depression, the cortical thinning is more diffuse and less severe.
We've got a structural signature for the brake failure in bipolar. What about the flip side? The mania itself? What's actually driving the upswing?
This is where dopamine enters the picture, and it's probably the most important neurochemical distinction between the two conditions. Both involve disruptions in monoamine signaling, serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine. But bipolar disorder has a unique feature, dopamine dysregulation that's bidirectional. In the depressive phase, dopamine signaling drops, similar to unipolar. But in mania and hypomania, dopamine surges. PET imaging studies show increased dopamine synthesis and release in the striatum during manic episodes. The unipolar brain doesn't seem capable of producing that surge, or at least not to the same pathological degree.
The protective factor. To go back to the prompt's wording, might literally be a ceiling on dopamine function. The unipolar brain can't get that high.
It's a compelling hypothesis. There's also a specific genetic finding, the gene CACNA1C, which codes for a calcium channel involved in neuronal excitability, is one of the most replicated risk genes for bipolar disorder. Variants in CACNA1C are associated with bipolar, but not consistently with unipolar depression. Calcium channels regulate how neurons fire, their rate and pattern of firing.
You've got a gene affecting how electrically excitable your neurons are, specifically linked to bipolar. That's almost too tidy.
It's one of those findings that makes you say, okay, maybe the biology really is cleaving these conditions at the joints. But, and this is important, it's not a clean break. There's overlap everywhere.
That's where I was going next, because I know there's a huge problem with misdiagnosis.
Estimates suggest somewhere between 40 and 60% of people with bipolar disorder are initially misdiagnosed with unipolar depression. The average delay to correct diagnosis is 5 to 10 years. And it's worse than just being treated for the wrong thing. Antidepressants without a mood stabilizer in someone with bipolar can trigger manic switches, accelerate cycling, make the whole thing more unstable.
Part of the answer to why does unipolar seem more common might actually be that some chunk of unipolar diagnoses are really bipolar in waiting.
That's a real concern. When you look at treatment-resistant depression, people who failed multiple antidepressant trials, a significant proportion turn out to have undiagnosed bipolar disorder. Some studies put it at 20 to 30%, which means the true prevalence gap might be somewhat narrower than the official numbers suggest. Not dramatically, unipolar is still much more common, but the bipolar numbers are almost certainly undercounted.
There's another layer here. The DSM draws a bright line between unipolar and bipolar, but the underlying biology may be more of a spectrum.
I know, but hear me out. There's a concept called the bipolar spectrum. The idea that between pure unipolar depression and classic bipolar 1, there's a range of conditions involving some degree of mood elevation. Bipolar 2, depression with hypomania. Cyclothymia, chronic low-grade mood instability. And then people with recurrent depression who've never had a clear hypomanic episode, but have a family history of bipolar, or brief periods of elevated mood that don't quite meet the threshold.
The people in the blurry middle.
Some researchers argue these people are biologically closer to bipolar than to unipolar, even if their label says major depressive disorder. The treatment implications are significant. These folks might do better on mood stabilizers than on antidepressants alone.
Which brings us back to the prompt's personal framing. He describes his depression as mild, unipolar, secondary to ADHD. I want to talk about the ADHD piece, because that's a wrinkle that doesn't get enough attention.
It's crucial. ADHD and bipolar share a lot of symptomatic territory. Impulsivity, emotional dysregulation, periods of high energy. They co-occur at rates way above chance. About 20% of people with ADHD also have a mood disorder, and the rate of ADHD in bipolar populations is even higher. Some studies put it at 30% or more.
If you've got ADHD and depression, the diagnostic question of, is this unipolar, or is there bipolar lurking, gets even trickier.
Because ADHD itself brings emotional lability. Rapid mood shifts tied to frustration, excitement, boredom, all cycling quickly. That can look like bipolar mood instability, but it's usually faster cycling and more reactive to immediate events. Bipolar mood shifts tend to be more sustained and less tied to what's happening around you.
The prompt mentions moving past a difficult batch and feeling happy it's behind him. That's not mania, that's relief. That's normal emotional processing after a hard period.
That distinction is everything. The unipolar person comes out of a depressive episode and returns to baseline, maybe even a baseline that feels euphoric by comparison, because anything feels good after misery. But it's not pathological. It's not the driven, sleepless, grandiose state of hypomania or mania. The bipolar person doesn't just feel better, they overshoot.
That's the word. The unipolar brain has a governor on it. The bipolar brain doesn't.
That governor may be one of the key protective factors the prompt is asking about. There's a concept in affective neuroscience called mood homeostasis, the brain's ability to return emotional states to a set point after perturbation. In unipolar depression, the set point is shifted downward, but the homeostatic mechanisms still function. You drift back up eventually. In bipolar, the homeostat itself is broken. It overshoots in both directions.
Which makes bipolar fundamentally a disorder of mood regulation, not just mood. Unipolar is more about a persistently low mood state.
This is reflected in the longitudinal course. Unipolar depression tends to be episodic. You have episodes, you recover between them. Bipolar disorder, even when treated, tends to show more chronic mood instability. The inter-episode periods are less stable, with sub-threshold symptomatology even when you're technically in remission.
The lived experience is different in a qualitative way, not just severity.
And this is where the prompt's glamorous twin framing is so sharp, because the cultural narrative has completely misunderstood what bipolar actually feels like. Hollywood shows the manic artist producing brilliant work. It doesn't show the mixed episodes, simultaneous depression and mania, one of the most agonizing states in all of psychiatry. It doesn't show the post-manic crash, where you survey the wreckage of relationships and finances. It doesn't show the cognitive decline that accumulates with each episode.
Wait, cognitive decline with each episode?
This is one of the most sobering findings in the literature. Both unipolar and bipolar depression involve cognitive impairment, attention, memory, executive function. But bipolar disorder shows a clearer pattern of progressive cognitive decline with repeated episodes, particularly manic episodes. Each manic episode seems to cause neurotoxic effects. Glutamate, excitotoxicity, oxidative stress, inflammation that damage neurons over time.
The very thing Hollywood romanticizes, the manic high, is literally causing brain damage.
That's why early diagnosis and mood stabilization is so critical. Every manic episode you prevent may be preserving cognitive function for the future. It's also why the antidepressant misdiagnosis problem is so dangerous. If you give an antidepressant to someone with undiagnosed bipolar and it triggers a manic episode, you've not only caused an acute problem, you may have contributed to long-term neurodegeneration.
That's a heavy thought. Let me pull us back to the prevalence question. Globally, what do the numbers look like?
The World Health Organization's World Mental Health Surveys put the 12-month prevalence of major depressive disorder at about 6% across countries, with lifetime prevalence around 12 to 15%. Bipolar spectrum disorders collectively affect about 2 to 3% of the global population, so unipolar is roughly 5 to 8 times more common, and this is remarkably consistent across cultures. Bipolar 1 is about 1% lifetime prevalence everywhere from the US to Nigeria to Japan to Brazil, one of the most cross-culturally invariant findings in psychiatry, which itself suggests a strong biological substrate.
Whereas depression varies more.
Depression does vary more across cultures, which again points to the greater role of environmental and social factors. War, poverty, displacement, these drive depression rates up in ways less true for bipolar. The genetic loading for bipolar is so high it punches through cultural variation almost entirely. Another angle, unipolar depression, is about twice as common in women as in men, one of the most robust findings in epidemiology. Bipolar disorder affects men and women at roughly equal rates.
Which again suggests different underlying mechanisms. If unipolar is so heavily environmentally shaped, and women face different environmental stressors, that could explain part of the gap.
Though the sex difference in depression isn't fully explained by environmental factors, there are hormonal hypotheses, immune system differences. But the fact that bipolar doesn't show that sex skew is telling.
What about age of onset?
Bipolar disorder typically emerges earlier. Peak age of onset is late adolescence to early adulthood, 15 to 25. Unipolar depression has a broader age range, with peaks in adolescence and again in later life. When you see a first depressive episode in someone over 40, it's much more likely to be unipolar. Bipolar almost always announces itself young.
Which makes the misdiagnosis problem even more tragic. You've got teenagers and young adults presenting with depression, and if nobody asks the right questions about prior mood elevation, they get labeled unipolar and put on antidepressants.
The right questions are so simple. Have you ever had a period of several days where you felt unusually energetic, needed less sleep, had racing thoughts, were more talkative than usual, engaged in risky behavior? These screening questions take 2 minutes, and yet they're underutilized in primary care, where most depression is diagnosed and treated.
Part of the problem might be that the depressed person doesn't think of their past hypomania as a problem. They remember it as the time they felt great and got everything done.
Ego syntonic versus ego dystonic. The depression feels like something wrong, something they want help with. The hypomania often feels like their best self. They don't report it because they don't see it as a symptom. So, the clinician has to actively fish for it.
Which takes time, training, and a system that doesn't incentivize 7-minute med checks. But the point stands. The distinction between unipolar and bipolar is not just academic. It has real, life-altering treatment consequences.
For unipolar depression, first-line treatments are antidepressants. SSRIs, SNRIs, bupropion, and evidence-based psychotherapies like CBT and interpersonal therapy. For bipolar depression, the picture is completely different. Antidepressants are controversial. Some guidelines recommend against them entirely. Others say they can be used cautiously, but always with a mood stabilizer on board. The risk of an antidepressant triggering a manic or hypomanic switch is well documented. Somewhere between 10 and 30% of bipolar patients given antidepressants without mood stabilizers will experience a treatment-emergent manic episode. And even without full mania, antidepressants can cause cycle acceleration.
The first-line treatments for bipolar depression are mood stabilizers. Lithium, lamotrigine, valproate, and some atypical antipsychotics like quetiapine and lurasidone.
Lithium deserves a special mention. It's one of the oldest drugs in psychiatry and still one of the most effective. Lithium has a unique property. It appears to have neuroprotective effects. Long-term lithium treatment is associated with preservation of gray matter volume, increased BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which supports neuron survival and possibly reduce dementia risk.
Lithium might actually slow or prevent some of that episode, related cognitive decline.
That's the hypothesis. It's another reason why getting the diagnosis right matters so much. You want the bipolar patient on lithium early, not on a series of antidepressants that might be making things worse.
What about psychotherapy? Does it work differently across the two conditions?
Psychotherapy is effective for both, but the focus differs. In unipolar depression, the heavy hitters are CBT and behavioral activation. In bipolar disorder, the evidence is strongest for psychoeducation, family-focused therapy, and interpersonal and social rhythm therapy. That's the one about regularizing daily routines. The idea is that bipolar disorder involves a disruption of circadian and social rhythms, and stabilizing these rhythms can stabilize mood. People with bipolar are exquisitely sensitive to disruptions in routine. Jet lag, shift work, and all-nighter can trigger episodes.
Which circles back to the homeostat idea. If the bipolar brain's mood homeostat is broken, you have to impose stability from the outside through rigid routine.
It's an external homeostat. Social rhythm therapy doesn't have the same evidence base in unipolar depression. Sleep and routine matter for everyone, but it's not the core mechanism. In unipolar depression, you're not trying to prevent mania, so the rhythmic stabilization is less critical.
Let me ask you something. The prompt gestures at, but doesn't state directly. Is there any evidence that the unipolar brain has something actively protective? Some mechanism that prevents mood escalation, rather than simply lacking the bipolar pathology?
There's intriguing work on cognitive control circuitry, the prefrontal systems that regulate emotional responses. In people with unipolar depression, these control systems are often intact enough to prevent escalation. They may even be upregulated as a compensatory mechanism. fMRI studies show increased prefrontal activation during emotion regulation tasks in people with unipolar depression compared to both healthy controls and people with bipolar disorder. It's as if the unipolar brain is recruiting extra resources to maintain stability, even if it can't maintain a positive mood.
The brake pads are worn, but you're pressing harder on the pedal.
The bipolar brain seems to have a failure in the brake system itself. The pedal goes to the floor and nothing happens. And that failure may be progressive. With each mood episode, the prefrontal amygdala connectivity degrades further. The homeostat gets more broken over time.
Which makes early intervention not just helpful, but urgent.
Urgent is the right word. And this is where the ADHD connection becomes particularly important. ADHD also involves prefrontal dysfunction, particularly in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, critical for attention and impulse control. So someone with ADHD and depression is already working with a compromised prefrontal system. The question is whether that compromise is the same kind that predisposes to bipolar or a different kind.
What's the answer?
The evidence suggests it's a different kind, overlapping but distinct. ADHD primarily affects the attention and executive control networks. Bipolar primarily affects the emotion regulation and reward networks. They share some circuitry, but the core pathology is in different systems. That said, having ADHD does increase the risk of developing bipolar disorder compared to the general population. So the systems are entirely independent.
The prompt author situation, ADHD with secondary unipolar depression, is actually a distinct profile from bipolar, even though they share surface features like impulsivity and emotional dysregulation.
And the treatment is different. Stimulants for ADHD can sometimes destabilize mood in people with bipolar. They can trigger mania. But in someone with ADHD and unipolar depression, stimulants are often safe and effective, and treating the ADHD can actually improve the depression. If your depression is secondary to the functional impairment of untreated ADHD, the chronic underachievement, the frustration, then addressing the ADHD lifts the depression.
Whereas in bipolar, you'd want to stabilize the mood first with a mood stabilizer before even thinking about treating the ADHD.
Korn, what about secondary depression more broadly? The prompt mentions his depression is often secondary to ADHD. Is secondary depression different from primary depression in terms of the unipolar versus bipolar distinction? Secondary depression. Depression arising in the context of another condition, whether ADHD, medical illness, or substance use, tends to be unipolar. The bipolar diathesis, that underlying predisposition to mood oscillation, isn't typically triggered by another condition, it's primary. So if your depression is clearly secondary to ADHD, that actually makes bipolar less likely, all else being equal.
Which might be reassuring to the person who asked.
It should be, though I'd add the caveat that ADHD and bipolar can co-occur, and the combination is not rare. So secondary depression doesn't rule out bipolar entirely, but it tilts the probabilities.
I think we've covered a lot of ground. Let me try to synthesize what we've said about the core question. What protects against emotional lability in unipolar depression? The protective factors, as best we can piece together. 1. Lower genetic loading for bipolar. Specifically, you didn't inherit the calcium channel variants, the dopamine dysregulation tendency, the circadian rhythm fragility. 2. Intact prefrontal inhibitory control. Your brake system works, even if your mood is low. 3. A functional mood homeostat that returns you to baseline rather than overshooting. 4. Possibly, the absence of the kind of dopamine surge capacity that drives mania. And 5. In cases of secondary depression, the fact that the underlying driver is something else, ADHD, life stress, medical illness, rather than a primary mood instability.
That's a solid synthesis. I'd add a sixth, the absence of episode-related neurodegeneration that degrades the homeostat over time. If you start out unipolar and stay unipolar, your regulatory circuitry remains relatively preserved. Each depressive episode is damaging, but not in the same accelerating way that manic episodes are.
The unipolar brain stays unipolar, partly because it's never been bipolar. There's something almost tautological about that, but I think it's true and important.
And it points to why early correct diagnosis matters so much. If you can prevent that first manic episode in someone who's at risk, you might alter the trajectory of the entire illness.
Before we wrap, I want to touch on something implicit in the prompt, the role of temperament. The prompt author describes himself in a way that suggests a certain emotional steadiness, even within depression. Is there a temperamental profile that maps onto unipolar versus bipolar?
There is, studied under the rubric of affective temperament. People who later develop bipolar disorder often show cyclothymic or hyperthymic temperaments pre-morbidly. Before the illness declares itself, they're already more emotionally reactive, more energetic, more prone to mood swings. People who develop unipolar depression often show depressive or anxious temperaments, more steady but negatively tilted.
The temperament is the soil the illness grows in.
That's a lovely way to put it. And the soil matters as much as the seed.
Let me flag one thing for listeners who might be worried about their own diagnosis. If you've been diagnosed with unipolar depression, and you're wondering whether it might actually be bipolar, what's the one thing you should do?
Ask for a thorough screening. There are validated tools. The mood disorder questionnaire, the hypomania checklist, that take a few minutes and can flag people who need a more detailed assessment. If you have a family history of bipolar disorder, if you've had a strange reaction to antidepressants in the past, if you've had periods of decreased need for sleep with elevated energy, not just insomnia, but feeling rested on 3 hours, those are red flags worth discussing with a clinician.
If you're the person with mild unipolar ADHD-adjacent depression, the prompt's author, take the boring diagnosis. Boring is underrated. Boring means your mood homeostat works. Boring means you're not at risk for the neurodegenerative effects of mania. Boring means the treatments are more straightforward and better studied.
Boring is a gift. The glamorous twin burns out early.
There's your pull quote.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During World War II, Tajikistan produced approximately 12,000 homemade crystal radio receivers using razor blades and pencil graphite as makeshift diodes, allowing remote mountain villages to receive Soviet state broadcasts for the first time.
Razor blades and pencil graphite. That's resourceful.
I'm now picturing a Tajik grandfather carefully positioning a razor blade to catch Radio Moscow.
That's gonna sit with me.
For more on the neurobiology of mood disorders, the references we discussed are available at My Weird Prompts. This has been My Weird Prompts with me, Herman Poppleberry, and my brother Korn. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.